This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You have reached the edge of the world.
Today on Dreamland, we have someone who has been at this a long time, is a genuine expert, a highly accomplished UFO researcher who is also at the absolute cutting edge of what's going on right now. And I've never interviewed him before on this show, his dad, who is now too late, he's passed on. We have Ryan Wood with us. Ryan is the author of Magic Eyes Only and a number of other books, including UFOs, Who Knows, which we'll be talking about extensively today. But more importantly, he literally is at the cutting edge. And Ryan, I would very much like to welcome you to Dreamland, and thank you for coming to spend some time with us.
It's great to be here, Whitley, and I'm glad we got a chance to meet at the Soul Foundation briefly and then follow up and do this interview. I think it'll be really fun.
Yeah, the Soul Foundation, folks who don't know about this is a foundation that was founded at, associated indirectly with Stanford University by Dr. Gary Nolan, whose name everybody knows, and Dr. Peter Skafish, who is also at Stanford and very interested in the UFO phenomenon and UAP phenomenon, but less well known, but a wonderful man anyway, and also much more friendly to close encounter witnesses and experiences than most of the Soul Foundation people. Yeah. I'm not allowed to speak at the Soul Foundation because I'm a close encounter witness. Most of the people who spoke at the foundation will not come on this show because they don't want to be tarred by the close encounter brush. But you were here, and that's a different story. So thank you on behalf of all of the close encounter witnesses who watch and listen to this show, and also the people who take an interest in it, for coming. I invited Admiral Tim Gallaudet and many others who spoke at the conference. Not one of them even replied.
Wow.
They didn't. And, you know, they got to get used to us, because this can't be done by authority figures who aren't in the experience. Ultimately, it's going to come down to the close encounter witnesses and the visitors and the people who are willing to engage with us. To try to isolate us and say, no, we don't want those people involved. We just want the government people involved and the official people involved. Yeah. Not going to work. There was a big convocation at the Esalen Institute a while ago that involved a lot of billionaires. They bought out the whole Esalen Institute for a few days, and they invited only people that they thought would have some kind of authoritative locomotion in this.
Right. But
they do not know the grace. The grace is very deceptive and very effective. They're going to do it their way, no matter what we think.
Right.
Okay. All that said, let's talk about you now. And your dad, you got into this at an early age. I mean, I remember you and your dad working on this many years ago.
Yeah. I mean, my father's sort of history, Dr. Robert Wood, who is a PhD physicist who graduated from Cornell and worked at Douglas Aircraft Company and then McDonnell Douglas and then Boeing for his 43 years. One day, I think in 1966 or so, his boss came into his office and said, "What are we going to do for the retirement of General Schriever," which was a general that specialized in rockets. And whimsically, he said, "Well, why don't we tell him how the UFOs do it?" And his boss said, "Sure, go work on that." And so he suddenly read 50 UFO books and made some conclusions. And then he was giving a briefing to his management at Douglas Aircraft Company. And after the briefing, the president, Don Douglas, asked him, Well, you know, what have you been doing for fun, Bob? And he said, well, I've read 50 UFO books and there's only one question left. And what's that? And he said, well, are we going to figure out how gravity works before or after Lockheed does? And there was some pregnant pause. And then they said, well, you know, how much money do you want to try to figure that out? And he said, well, I want $500,000, which was about, you know, $5 million today or something. And so they gave him the money. And for the next couple of years, they worked hard on trying to figure out gravity control, but they also interviewed abductees and experiencers. They instrumented vans and went out to the De Mojave Desert, tried to collect data, and they did theoretical work and so forth. This was all the boys in the back room work for the next 2 or 3 years. And subsequently, Stan Friedman, a famous graybeard in ufology, which you certainly knew, and I did too.
Oh, well.
Yeah, exactly. And he came home to dinner one time when I was like 15 years old. And so I got a little brief exposure to ufology then. And then sort of, you know, I went on my way in life. And it wasn't until, oh, maybe 1990s, early 90s, that my father and I connected again and started working diligently on authenticating the Majestic documents. So that's how I came into this field. I mean, never had any experiences. I've been an analyst, sort of an intellectually curious person in the field, and you know, try to do what I can do to contribute to its progress.
So you didn't ever work at McDonnell Douglas or any.
No, I had started off working at Intel Corporation as a new college graduate, and then Digital Equipment Corporation, and then a couple of Silicon Valley startups in medical imaging, and then ultimately moved to Colorado with a company in energy conservation. Then I started Frontline Aerospace, which for 15 years I focused on drones and energy conservation. And now I'm the CEO of Electric Fusion Systems, which we're working on small scale fusion in a roller bag sort of environment, a different approach to a radiation free portable fusion power electricity. So that's my day job. My a hobby is ufology.
Well, it's quite a day job. Incidentally, folks, if you hear banging in the background, the buildings that we came very close to being burned down a few weeks ago, and everyone around here is retrofitting their structures for fire suppression. And so everyone has people up on their roofs trying to do that, and you'll hear some of that banging and hopefully, if it won't get too loud, but if I didn't do the, it'll be like this for weeks. Okay. You mentioned a moment ago the presence of abductees and close encounter witnesses in this whole mix. And what I'd like to do is to ask you where they fit in. Because, as I said earlier, they're not being fitted in properly anymore. They may have been in the past, but not now. But before we go there, folks, I think we're just about to find out something quite extraordinary here. And we're going to take a little break, and we'll be right back. We're talking to Ryan Wood. His most recent book, UFOs, Who Knows? And we will be talking about that. And don't worry about holding it up. It'll be up on we have a the video editor will put a copy of it up when I'm talking about it. So you don't need to worry about holding it up.
Okay.
All right. This podcast has been going on for a long time, and you can be assured it's a completely professional operation. In any case, there's a book by Grant Cameron called UFO Sky Pilots. Are you familiar with that book at all?
Not really.
Well, okay. Well, let me tell you what it is. It's a compilation of statements by close encounter witnesses who have flown UFOs.
Hmm.
And it's so extensive that I have to believe that something like that might have happened. And can you tell us what you know about any involvement of close encounter witnesses in the whole gravity research program?
Well, I guess my approach to gravity research has been trying to figure out the origin point of the reverse engineering and technology effort. And I'm not sure it overlaps much in the way of interfacers so far as what I've known. There was a huge smattering of newspaper articles in the 50s that highlighted many different corporations, from the Glenn Martin Company to Sperry, Gyroscope, to Lear, to Northrop, to many of these early people. And I've actually traced back the first article to 1951, where Dudley Clark had a group of scientists out in the Coachella Valley in Palm Springs, with some $6 million down a dirt road, working on quote gravity insulators, and then I've looked through a lot of different people as well. One of the key linchpins or organizations is what's called the RIAS group, Research Institute of Advanced Studies, that George S. Trimble sort of founded and championed as part of the Glenn L. Martin Company. And this guy Trimble was the arch villain, or, you know, lead character in Nick Cook's book, The Hunt for Zero Point. And he's been requested, people have asked him, you know, can I talk to you about gravity control? And he says, hell no, go away. Don't talk to me. And recently I found Lewis Witten, another physicist of that era in the RIAS group, who's 102 years old, living in a nursing home in Maryland, and had a personal introduction to him and an email exchange with him. And he said the same thing. He said, hell no, I can't talk to you about all gravity control at all. So this is a long-winded answer to say that I think that our science, human beings, figured out gravity control, I would say in 1960, plus or minus 2 years. And then I went into a lot of other research, which is a separate presentation really, about what sort of sightings and events support the nature of gravity control and manipulation. But I'm sorry, I don't have anything directly related to interfacers that, you know, highlight that. Do you?
I'm sorry, I'm muting my mic while the riot. Of course, it was just a slight bit of banging, but now as soon as we start talking, it sounds like they're actually tearing down the place next door. Any case, what I want to do is you mentioned that we may have already got gravity control. And, you know, the question of what gravity is, I'm not alone in having been in a UFO among close encounter witnesses, and I can describe part of the experience very clearly, and it's important, it's related to this. It is that even though I could see there was little windows, they were sort of, they weren't big, but I could see out of them. And as we returned to the place in the woods that we had started from, it looked like the world outside was moving around, and the thing was as steady and still as a living room. And that was because it had its own gravity. You know, if you go into a movie, and an old movie, and you watch a pilot's view of a dogfight, the world, the cockpit is just still and steady because you're basically sitting in a movie theater, and the world outside is moving around, and so it's. But if you were actually in the plane, it would look different. However, when you're in a UFO, it's absolutely, it has its own gravity, and therefore it's not connected in some way to this universe. And if that's true, I think it's not just gravity control, it's the creation of a whole different realm of reality when you turn something like that on. Go ahead.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, there's discussions of, well, is it manipulating inertia? Is it manipulating time? Are you interdimensionally somehow twisted? It's definitely a different thing. And I guess I'd draw a distinction between a real extraterrestrial craft and our own man-made craft, which may be more... crude or less sophisticated in its capabilities. And that's actually one of the key areas where I'm doing remote viewing targets on several of these early cases in 64 and 66, and maybe some other cases that are back into the 50s, where it's clear that there's human beings with military uniforms on that are operating these crafts rather than the Greys or Pleiadians or Nordics or others.
Yeah, there's a big human factor here. And it's so secret, though. God, so secret. I mean, you're not alone. And I've inquired of people who have done this kind of research, and they get belligerent. They don't just... You know, mostly when you're trying to find something out from somebody who has a clearance in some area, they're pretty nice about it. But these guys are not. I mean, they say basically go away. I'm not. You know, it's almost like something is watching them from the inside.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that the greatest secret on planet Earth, in my opinion, is gravity control. And that somebody has it either outside the military industrial complex or some sort of breakaway civilization or some sort of different group that may be in partnership with some faction of alien presence. But that's the ultimate secret, because that is free energy. That is disruption of the planet. That is the solution to our fundamental problems of ecology and getting rid of the nukes and uplifting humanity to, as Stan Friedman used to say, join the cosmic kindergarten long ago. And so that, along with low-cost portable fusion, is two technologies that I think could have positive transformational trajectory for planet Earth to allow us to sort of, again, join the cosmic kindergarten and have a more open dialogue with the alien presence.
A more open dialogue, because right now it's very closed. And as I found out, as this emerges into the some of the people from behind the scenes are emerging into the public space, they want that door to stay closed. They want to tell the public what's going on, but they don't want us in the room. They don't want us in the room.
Yeah, I agree. They don't want. I mean, there's so many negative implications or unknowable implications for some form of high quality disclosure, so to speak. And disclosure is such a huge question mark as to what that is and what it entails.
Yeah, what would high quality be? That's a question. And I want to let's unpack that a little bit. What would you say? How would you describe high quality disclosure?
Well, I mean, it's a continuum, really. I mean, we're not alone in the universe. Everybody goes, okay, yawn. I get that. But Roswell's real. Well, can we see the bodies? Well, no, you can't. But okay, 2 years later, they say, here they are. Well, did you guys do any biological or virological analysis of their blood? Have you created any bioweapons? Have you figured out any reverse engineering technologies like Colonel Corso advocated? And well, no, you can't see those, but yeah, we did some. And this is sort of titrates it all out. And then let alone going to the really nasty stuff like, you got time travel and all your religions. I mean, Jesus and Muhammad and all these people are basically aliens and they're manipulating global society. And or you got gravity and the whole world economic system is turned on its head in a negative way, potentially. There's so many different ways you could, and my book, The AI Ufologist, talks a little bit about that. How do you go about managing the transparency aspect and the disclosure aspect? How do you juggle this to sort of titrate out a reasonable process with minimum disruption for society? And it's the pull the Band-Aid off or sort of absorb the slow drip, drip, drip.
Well, yeah. And the, of course, pulling the Band-Aid off results in what they call ontological shock, which is the shock of the new. And in my book, The Fourth Mind, the one that's just recently out, I say at one point, people always say, oh, sure, we're ready. But for what? Yeah. We don't know what it is we're supposed to be ready for, so we're actually not ready. And these the insiders hold the cards very close to their chest. And even though you go on Ross Coulthard or any of these other shows, you see one supposed insider after another coming out. But they're not really doing that. They're only feeding us an awareness of the fact that there's something real there, and there's a sense of some kind of a conflict going on, and a feeling on my side, because I live with the visitors. They're a huge part of my life. I couldn't write a word without my relationship with them. It's that deep. And then I'm told that. Sit here and listen to these people talking about shooting them and shooting them, like shooting the little, we were talking about this on the air just before we started, folks. And I just want to air this out a little bit. Jake Barber talks about shooting them. And okay, that's in what he shoots. What the only ones we ever get close to are the little short ones, 3 feet tall, that are biomechanical. They don't have reproductive organs. And I know a lot about them because I describe them in detail in my book. But here's the thing. He said they were like meat puppets. I'm sorry. They're not. They have brains bigger and more complex than our own. It's true that they are not independent entities like a human being, or like one of the 5 foot tall grays, but they still matter. And shooting them matters. It matters. And these people represent us, but we have no voice in the policies that are behind what they do.
Yeah, it seems kind of silly. I mean, I suspect that they have lots of examples of the biology and the people. Why do they need any more? And they've got plenty to work on. I think, the directive should not be to engage or shoot down any of this. It's what, you have plenty to work on already. So, I suppose they're always trying to find more data, but I just think it's silly.
It's possible to interact with the grays very fully without shooting them down, because I and many close encounter witnesses do this all the time. And I know they have people behind the scenes that they call variously psionics or intuitives that can do it too. But the way they do it is totally, it doesn't seem to me to be the right way. And let's take another break. We're talking to Ryan Wood. His latest book, UFOs, Who Knows? He is the author of one of the great classics of this field, Magic Eyes Only. And we're going to be talking about both of those books as we move along. We'll be right back. We're talking to Ryan Wood. His website, Magic Eyes Only. Magic Eyes Only, and it is a beautifully laid out website where you can learn about Ryan's work, at least his UFO work, not so much about his other work, which I want to talk about a little bit right now.
Okay.
You described what would be conceivably the most revolutionary energy change in energy delivery in the history of mankind, and you're working on it.
Yeah, I am. And
with this.
so there are we're a members of the Fusion Industry Association, which is a global organization of all the fusion companies. And there's 43 companies in the world working on fusion, nuclear fusion. And three of them, or actually I think four, are what's called antineutronic, or without neutrons, without radiation, fusion approaches. The rest generate neutrons and fusion. They can be shielded and so forth. But that's our focus. And our fundamental breakthrough is this low-cost fusion fuel, which is a combination of lithium, ammonia, and noble gases in this heavy Rydberg matter liquid condensate that gets fused with electrical arcing in a small pressurized vessel, something the size of a large beer can, with a switching power supply and some way to extract it. But the key breakthrough is in quantum tunneling and frustrated tunneling and reduced Coulombic repulsion, which is the nemesis of how you smash atoms together, is that they don't want to go together at all. They want to repel.
Right.
And so if you can sort of these Rydberg atoms are actually much larger electron clouds that have much higher principal quantum numbers, and therefore they interact with each other in a different novel way that allows magnetic and electrical fields to be far more sensitive. So that was a long technical dialogue about sort of technically how we do it. But my website, electricfusionsystems.com, explains this all in detail. But we're right on the verge of being really weird and not accepted by mainstream science because, although we have a lot of papers and supporting information and pending patents and so forth, we are not mainstream in our approach. And it's a much longer dialogue as to how and why we or our team came to this technology. But we think we'll succeed if we can get the $3 million that we need to sort of push the envelope and get it done in less than a year. So that's sort of where we're at. I mean, as usual, we're a struggling startup.
Well, you know, isn't that a familiar story, though? A startup with a fascinating approach, a creative approach, and mainstream science putting a heavy hand on its progress. And this is something, and what you described, you obviously know a good bit about what you're doing, but it doesn't fit a series of assumptions that the same mindset that assumed that rocks couldn't fall out of the sky is a ridiculous idea, and that assumed that no voice could ever be transmitted across the air, across a distance any farther than someone could shout. That same mindset is still holding us back.
Right.
More powerful now than it ever was before, for a simple reason: the amount of money that's necessary that you just mentioned is often very substantial. And you're stymied. Isn't there anyone out there who's willing to take anyone with money willing to take a risk? I know that there's lots of billionaires out there nowadays, more than we should have probably, but I don't see them willing to take this kind of risk.
Yeah, it's the objections to funding are around having a high quality white paper or peer reviewed papers, or finding subject matter experts in fusion that say that, well, this is interesting, this looks like it has a reasonable chance of succeeding, even though it's sort of outside the mainstream approach. The potential positive impact on uplifting humanity is huge, and relatively non-destructive. I would say it's less turmoil than gravity control. You basically can suck water out of the air and you know, green the desert, or make food anywhere, or you know, eliminate a lot of the, you can put it in the back of a Tesla or an electric car and they suddenly go a million miles. It's huge applications that are all positive.
Yes. So
I think it's a key, and environmentally, it will be tremendously helpful to, you know, and what do the ETs care about, right? As you've mentioned before in your podcast, you know, get rid of the nukes, clean up the environment, feed everybody, educate everybody, and improve the standard of living for everybody. And when you do that, you can join the cosmic kindergarten, sort of my assessment of the situation.
Yeah. Although, you know, it may not be a cosmic kindergarten. A couple of weeks ago, we had a show on Dreamland where the gentleman who was there showed image after image of artifacts on the moon and Mars that had been airbrushed out by NASA.
Ah.
That means that we have a past we're not allowed to know about. Mm. And what can that be? Why would something that's it? The very least thousands and maybe many more years old be so secret that NASA has to airbrush it out on the moon and Mars?
Yeah.
So who the hell are we?
Right.
And, you know, you're trying to do something that would revolutionize the human experience. It's not a small thing, but you're like pushing against a wall that you can't get through.
Well, you know, we're just keep pushing. It's my attitude is just keep going. And
exactly. That's what we have to do. Now, I want to get on to your books.
Oh, yeah.
Magic Eyes Only, Ryan, is one of the great classics. Of you don't need to hold it up. We'll hold it up.
Yeah. Okay. I started it in 2005 at the Crash Retrieval Conference, and it was, as you mentioned, a classic. It had 74 crashes from around the world, from 1897 to present. Jim Mars, the late Jim Mars, wrote the foreword for that book, and I recently updated it about a year ago, and it had 104 crashes from around the world, expanded it, and added more. And I left three or four on my desk because I just needed to get the book done. So I felt, you know, that I, after, you know, starting out in 2003 with the UFO crash retrieval conferences, which ran for 7 years, I think that you attended some of them, I can't remember. You may have spoken at one. And David Grush shows up, last summer or the summer of 23, and says to the world, yeah, there really are crash retrievals. And we were like 18 years ahead of time. And I'm excited about my book, you know, Magic Eyes Only. And it's a tremendous compendium of cases, and this they have varying quality and sophistication, and many people have written whole books on Kecksburg or Shag Harbor or Roswell or Braxton County or Cape Girardeau, and so I'm just trying to synthesize those down to, you know, anywhere from one page with a, you know, intriguing witnesses or articles to, you know, 10 pages where you have a lot of information. So that's the focus of Magic Eyes Only.
Well, let's talk about a couple of those. Let's talk first about Kecksburg, because that's an absolutely fascinating case, and it's very well documented. Can you tell us a little bit about that in Kecksburg? Something happened in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, folks.
And right. Ryan's gonna
give us a scoop.
Yeah. So, this Acorn type craft came in and crashed and scraped along the ground. And Stan Gordon is the primary investigator, has written a book on this case. And Leslie Keene as well has done some research on NASA FOIA documents related to this. And it comes in the guy by the name of, I think, John Murphy, was a local reporter and photographer, came and took a bunch of pictures, and then the military showed up and confiscated his film. However, I believe that he actually palmed the film off into a one pocket and gave them basically blanks. And he mysteriously died in Ventura County in a drunken head-on with a Volkswagen bus that he was in. And then the toxicology report is suddenly missing from Ventura County. And when I had some remote viewers target the actual event, he was murdered. But nevertheless, that's sort of a sidebar, but the point is that he had this crash. You have writing and hieroglyphics on the side. There's a bunch of pictures, cordoned off, military, take it all away. It's a classic event. Everything sort of, you know, it crashes, there's some witnesses, they cordon off the area, the military carts it away, and it's difficult to find anything more about it. And that's sort of the universal motif of crash retrievals.
Yeah, and it's extremely frustrating. I'm very familiar with the Roswell incident because one of my uncles was involved in it. My listeners know all about this. I'm not going to go into it again, but just suffice to say, he was attached to the Air Materiel Command at Wright Field when the debris and bodies were brought in. And yeah. So it's a family affair in my life. And he said to me that they looked into the craft that they had, and there was nothing in it. There's no propulsion system. And I wonder if there's any information anywhere about propulsion systems that you've come across in your journey through this whole field, not just crash retrievals, but you and your dad have been deep into this on a lot of different levels. So any
there's some of the Majestic documents, for example, on majesticdocuments.com website, there's the White Hot Report, which is September of 1947, which describes the neutronic power plant. It has 10 different bullet points about what the materials are inside this propulsion power plant, as well as this, I don't know, it's 25-page report all about the event. And what they learned through the whole summer of 47, trying to analyze the craft. And so I would urge people to read that, because it's a fascinating read. And it's actually one of the higher quality, more authentic Majestic documents. But I'll read one quote from UFOs Who Knows that was relevant to what you said earlier. This is from Brigadier General Arthur E. Exon. We heard the material was coming to Wright Field. It was brought into our material evaluation labs. I don't know how it arrived, but the boys who tested it said it was very unusual. I mean, it's sort of, you know, so-so comment, but
he was a family friend.
Right. Oh, he was for you?
We talked extensively about this for a couple of hours, actually.
Well, you probably know a lot more. But there's just an example of somebody who ran Wright-Patterson Air Force Base Air Material Command.
General Exon knew a lot.
Well,
I'm not going to be coy about it. I've said it before, he held one of the bodies in his arms.
Wow.
Yeah. And he was as late as 1988, he was still consulting with people at Wright Pat who were working on this, because it was always pencils up in his day. Nobody left any written records of what they were talking about. And then the Air Force put it about, he started to get too talkative. And the Air Force, unfortunately, I introduced him to Stan Friedman. And I told Stan, next thing I knew, stuff had appeared like you just read. He ended up, it was put about that he had Alzheimer's, had Alzheimer's. I don't think he did. He may have, I don't know, because it reached a point where I couldn't communicate with him anymore either. Nobody could. And the last thing I heard from him, he says, I think my phones are bugged.
Right.
So,
there's many quotes in UFOs Who Knows from Obama's coy response on Larry King who's really in charge. Well, the ETs don't want us to tell the truth about what's going on, and to things like Ben Rich, the head of Lockheed Skunk Works for 15 years, saying we know how to take ET home. We found a mistake in the equations, and we can now travel to the stars. In his retirement speech in 1993, or Edgar Mitchell's comments, where there's clearly been crashed hardware, and people in the government know about this.
Edgar would talk about it extensively privately, but try to get him to say a darn thing on a radio or TV show, forget it, he wouldn't.
Yeah. And what's interesting about Who Knows is that we have these categories. We did astronauts, we did religious leaders, we did military, we did presidents, we did government leaders. We did a lot of work on celebrities and the celebrities' comments. I mean, so we wanted to give a good cross-section of people to allow the public to engage with the people that they feel comfortable with. You know, I don't believe in military leaders, but boy, the fact that Katy Perry said something about UFOs, hey, or LeBron James or Cassius Clay or, you know, these other people that people resonate with. And so it was my attempt, along with my co-author, Anthony DiLorenzo, to improve the credibility of the field. And that was the focus of what we're trying to do, is to just engage more people and up the credibility of ufology.
The credibility of ufology. Yeah, speaking of celebrities, when I went on the Johnny Carson show many years ago for communion, I was warned by my publicist that I was probably going to be taken down because Carson could be pretty brutal if he wanted to be. And so I thought, well, you know, I've been beaten up so much, I don't care anymore. You know, it was a horrible experience to go out there with communion. So I'm sitting in the green room waiting, and he comes in. And he says, and this is rare, he rarely went into the green room, apparently. And he says, well, I want to tell you a story. And he tells a story. He was sitting out on his deck at his home in Malibu with his wife. And they see a UFO circle the house, silver UFO, just as clear as day. And then I go on the show, and I'm on the show for half an hour, and he's incredibly nice to me. And I thought to myself, thank you guys for the help, because you saved me from an agonizing experience and really pushed the book, because that's what put communion on the map more than anything else I did.
Yeah. Now,
so that gets me to this. Where are we in terms of our relationship here? Because we've got people on the secret side of this now admitting they're in a shooting war. They're shooting them down. And then people like me and so many other Close Encounter witnesses out there saying, let's do this. Let's have a relationship. And people like you watching everything and trying to keep a good perspective on them. And it's that perspective I want to talk about right now. How can you do this in a way that it actually helps mankind instead of the fractured mess that we're in right now?
Yeah. Well, that is the big challenge, is that I guess in the past 20 years, we've had an increasing awareness of the extraterrestrial presence in our media and our movies, and more and more exposure to it. So it's certainly far less shocking today than it was, you know, in the 50s or 60s or 70s. So to some extent, that's been a positive trend. The question is, do you want to somehow accelerate that trend, and how to do that? How to increase transparency and trust in our government by telling the truth? And I guess it has to be done delicately and a little bit at a time. They could start by saying, you know, yeah, Roswell was a real event, and then try to manage the aggressive attack of the press to try to dig more and more and more and more, and feed them a little bit at a time to sort of let it come out so that there's less anxiety about it. But in... it's a complicated matter as to, you know, how to do this. And there's probably lots of different competing approaches within the government as to what to do and how to say it. But I'm struggling a little bit with, you know, a good script or a good prescription of
how to do that.
to respond. What do you think? I mean, how do you think it should be done?
Well, I think that there is a desire to hold their clinging. The authorities are clinging to something that they really can't hold on to. It's like clinging to dust or something. They don't know what they have here. Well, like for example, in Jake Barber's interview with Ross Coulthard, he describes at one point as he is attempting to retrieve this egg-shaped object that something came out of it and went into him and possessed him and is still inside him. And it's a very feminine, angelic, beautiful energy. Now, what he doesn't know is that many an abductee, including this one, can tell you exactly what happened. That was an attempt to reduce his hostility. In other words, this was, he thinks of it as a being. I mean, it probably is in some sense a being, and it's now part of him. But what he doesn't understand is that it's not technology. It's, we don't even have a word for it. It's spiritual structure that comes into him and changes him from basically a hostile warrior into something very different and sends him on the spiritual search he's on right now.
Right.
Now, this is what they can't get their heads around. They want this to be basically like us, only they're in UFOs. It's not like us at all. Not at all.
It's a very complicated, you wonder, I remember Chet Snow's title of his book, Mass Dreams of the Future.
That book. Yeah, tell us, give us some of your thoughts about it.
Well, I mean, I just triggered the thought was, how do you help humanity sort of get less militaristic and less aggressive and less, what this spiritual entity, or thing came into this barber's being is to somehow influence the dreams or perceptions of lots of human beings. I mean, there's lots of ways to be interfaced, either physically or mentally or in your dreams. And, there's a crop circle for melatonin, should everybody be taking melatonin to improve the quality of their sleep and therefore their telepathic and ESP ability or their receptiveness to positive things? Or you could take it a totally different way and say, I've heard that, some ETs have said the problem with humanity is the ratio of men to women is off. It's a 50-50 right now, but it really should be 5x female and 1x male because the females are more empathetic, they're more considerate, they're less warring, dot, dot, dot. It's not about procreation, but it's about these mental attitudes that could improve the happiness of planet Earth. And so, that's kind of a weird comment. I get that.
Among the grays, the females are very, they lead the species, and the males are much more passive. I've known those families, some of them, and a woman might have quite a few different males in her life. And not like us. In us, it's the opposite. The male is more aggressive in our chemistry. And I'm saying our chemistry, but in their chemistry, it's the opposite. But we have to think to ourselves of where do we go now?
Right.
Because we're at a very important inflection point. Stuff is coming out. There are billionaires gathering at Esalen, basically trying to figure out, how do we monetize this? Mm. How do we monetize the soul?
Yeah.
I wasn't at Esalen at that conference, but no matter how they approached it, how they looked at it, it was that. That was what the conference would have been about, even though they might not have looked at it that way.
Yeah. I mean, where do we go from here? And I guess my perspective right now is the fundamental challenges of ufology and this trajectory is three things. It's credibility, it's leadership, the leadership of individuals like yourself and other podcasters and other people, and money.
And the leadership of people like you, Ryan.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's right, exactly. It's all of us. We're all working together towards a better, common, happier planet, more in harmony. I mean, everybody, every sane person can recognize that having nukes on planet Earth is a bad idea. And having our environment so degraded is a bad idea. And so you can start with those premises. And if you aren't working towards those problems, you're not helping in a big way. That's sort of, leadership is about just doing what you can do, what you're passionate about, and what you can make a difference at. And everybody has their own capability and ability to execute on those things. But that's my assessment of the situation sort of right now. And one of the things that I've been working on is my software tool, our AI tool called UFODEX, UFODEX.com, which right now has around 750,000 pages of UFO books, periodicals, National Archive material, FBI files, and so forth. And it is this giant sort of clean repository of information that you can ask any question you want about, and you get your answer in 24 hours or so via email. But that's a tool that, as it matures and gets bigger and more real time, can help answer people's questions about how they can help and what the perspective is of ETs and all the history of ufology. So I just think more transparency, more openness, more completeness will all help the situation in the long run.
Yes, I understand that. And this is where we have to go. And we have to find a meeting ground between the people and on the inside and the people on the outside. That's very, very important. We can't have a situation where the people on the inside are basically teaming up with an isolated group of very wealthy individuals to try to control the situation and to try to exploit it in any way that they can. It has to be better. We have to do better than that. And to me, that means that the ordinary person has got to have direct access to this information. And also that when people people should be able to build a relationship with this cosmic presence. Because after all, it's about us. Where we are right now in terms of our history is we're either going to die out or we're going to become a cosmic species. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
Over the 50 or 100 years, that's going to happen. And it's going to be very, very real, like on a daily basis, more and more every single day. So I want to thank you for being with us, Ryan. Ryan Wood's books, UFOs, Who Knows, and his Magic Eyes Only, his website magiceyesonly.com, and his engineering, his fusion energy website, electricfusionsystems.com. follow Ryan and Ryan's work, because it's very important stuff. And he's a quiet, gentle, but very determined man who's been at this a long time and follows in his father's footsteps. Thank you, Ryan, for being with us on Dreamland.
Thank you, Whitley.
Thank you for listening. Dreamland is brought to you by Unknown Country and its family of subscribers. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our site coordinator is Amy Safrankova. The founder of UnknownCountry.com is Ann Strieber. I'm Whitley Strieber, your host for Dreamland.